Welcome to Carrying Wayward, a supernatural podcast for fans who aren't ready to let go and newcomers to this series who are ready to jump in. I'm Marie Vigouroux.
And I'm Drew Schulman. In this episode, we're diving into Supernatural Season 8, Episode 3, Heartache. Let's get this show on the road.
It is chaotic tonight in the Carrying Wayward virtual studio.
We're being crazy.
We have completely forgotten how to record. We almost didn't press record. And then I forgot how to say basically Carrying Wayward. We also took episodes for this notes last week. And so we both completely forgot that we had taken notes already. And so we were like, did we watch this?
Oh, we both had that exact same level of like, oh no, did we do this?
Now, before we actually get started with this episode, we did want to remind you that I'm going to be at the Supernatural Convention in New Jersey next month. So stay tuned next week because we're going to have something cool to talk about.
You're going to have such a good time and I cannot wait to like hear all about it and like see photos of people there with you. Oh my God.
I'm honestly so excited because I got a bunch of photo ops with all of the women of Supernatural, and it's going to be like Women Con, and I am so excited. Like, oh my God.
This week, patrons and coffee supporters got to hear us answer the question, what skill or ability do you wish you had on the supporter exclusive Impala Talk feed? You can go to carryingwayward.com to support us and claim your perks.
So how did you feel about this episode?
I'm going to use the word torn, which I know is a bit of a specific word to use in this episode, but not for that reason. The title of the episode and the fact that the thing they're stealing is hearts made me very like, ooh, hearts mean things. This is always important. And then the episode was very like an episode. Yes, there was some development in the characters, but I think a lot of that comes from like, not very plot-driven parts of it. It's more of just, like, the discussion around them. But, like, the actual, like, villain and, like, the creature and, like, the mysticism and the other characters, like, it really feels like a flat episode. Like, I think the reason we had trouble writing this one and remembering if we watched it was because it was just so meh.
I do blame very specific people for this, and we will get to that once we get to the long game. But first, can you please give us a recap of this episode?
Count me down.
3, 2, 1, Brick Holmes!
We get a dude's heart ripped out of his chest, and then we find out that Dean is like aware, like, oh, this is a pattern. It's happened in a few different places multiple times. I didn't investigate it the first time, but I'm investigating it now, and Sam, you're coming with me because I'm all in the mood to solve cases. They eventually track it down to potentially a dead football player. They're this ancient person who's hundreds and hundreds of years old who's been praying to a god by sacrificing a heart every few years. And after an organ transplant, other people gained his powers and abilities, and for the most part have followed the tradition. They stop them. Time.
This episode was written by Brad Buckner and Eugenie Ross Lemming. Those are the people I blame for how bad this episode was. It was directed by none other than Jensen Ackles, and it originally aired on October 17th, 2012.
I can see the Jackals directing in this a little bit. I think it's a positive thing because like the little moments of this episode that kind of felt fun and enjoyable felt more like Jensen making choices for his character, which makes a lot of sense when he also directed it.
I completely agree with you. If we can jump into the long game here, I do want to point out before anything else, before we get into any kind of other discussion, that this is going to be a weird season for Jared and Jensen in terms of self-tanner.
I watched this like a little bit earlier in the day, so my TV has a bit of glare. And I was very concerned. I'm like, is this like a combination of color blindness and bad lighting? Or is this actually a thing? Their Oompa Loompa phase.
I don't know what they were being told to do, but there you go. Like they are quite orange. Let's put it that way. I also have to get it out there that this episode is just outrageous in so many ways, in big part because of who wrote it. And we are going to talk about different aspects of that throughout the episode.
It needs to be said, so good.
We are also graced with a father-son duo this episode. Jensen's father, Mr. Alan Ackles, plays Detective Pike.
I didn't catch that earlier. Like, no, oh, that's so sweet. Aw.
We are back to the Rock aliases. After almost a whole season of leaving them behind, Sam answered the phone, identifying himself as Agent Sambora.
God bless. I truly did miss that little Easter egg every week.
It's that DNA of the show that's like coming back to itself. I'm pretty sure that everyone would rather just forget the Amazons episode because of just how awful it was, but not them. No, no, sir. They bring it back to mind by bringing back Dr. Morrison, the anthropologist who helped him on that case.
What a strange and unnecessary pull.
Very unnecessary.
The fact that, like, Dean even goes, like, who? And Sam's like, the character from that one time that was relevant because I said so. Shaking my head.
It was tacky. It was kind of tacky, I found.
It was.
Even broken clocks are right twice a day, so I do need to highlight this line from the episode that says, the heart is key. It is the focus of the sacrifice. Because again, hearts mean stuff on Supernatural. And in an episode that is called Heartache, I couldn't let it slide.
That line and that title made me expect greater things from this episode.
And I'm going to close this long game just by pointing you to the choice of colors in Sam's flashback. Like, I just want you to think about like those oversaturated greens, that dreamy blur.
I definitely noticed how dreamy and colorful it was, which to me was just like a how happy he truly was. You now have me concerned that it's more than that, or less than that, or something.
I do need to point it out now. That is all I'm going to say. This week, our theme is legacy, which has a Latin root that means ambassador, envoy, or deputy. So we can see that there's this idea of like somebody or something representing you when you can't be there, right? A representation of the self in the absence of the self. And today we use the word to mean in part like the long-lasting impact of a person's life, which is the definition that we're going to be focusing on today. Now, you all know that one of the brain worms that lives rent-free in my head is the legacy of Supernatural. I've talked about it a lot, particularly in our special episodes. And so obviously I'm going to have some thoughts bubbling through for critical time.
I think it's easy to frame Sam as like dismissive of legacy, but I think it's like so much more important to understand that like your legacy and the legacy you uphold should not come at the cost of your own self. Sam had the year off from hunting and went to experience a life that he thought he was going to like have before season 7-8 happened, being dragged back in. And even now he's hunting again with a goal in mind, like not just upholding his family business. Now he's in it to finish it so he can go back to the happy life he just had.
Yeah. Well, I think that this year, like Sam basically started thinking about like a different kind of legacy. Because like you said, I think there's like the easy way out in this case, like to say that Sam just like is dismissing legacy. But really, I think that he's really just asking himself, like, if the family business is really the legacy that he wants to leave. Like, he'd already left it once to go to Stanford and to become a lawyer. That was him choosing what he wanted to do and the impact that he wanted to have on the world and the people around him. And of course, we know that Sam came back to hunting, right? Because after the pilot episode, that's just what happens. Jess is murdered. And then after that, like things just kind of like snowballed and leaving just wasn't really an option anymore until it was again, like over the course of this year. And in a way, like this is really powerful, right? It's the idea that you're not stuck where you are, that you can change the path that you're on, even if you're really well engaged in it.
It's loaded to me because I feel like the idea of legacy is almost like used in a way to like pigeonhole someone. And here Sam is seeing the idea of like, oh no, I don't have to do that. I don't have to be this thing because I was told to. You know, the way Sam looks at it this week, specifically this case, it's revealing as well. Like, I want to be clear. I'm not for or against this myself, but he no longer sees the need or the drive to go after every little case. His goals are to get Kevin, get the tablet, close the gates, go back to Amelia and the pup. Like, really, until now, Sam's only reason to keep hunting was a sense of justice and being there for Dean, and he's seen that there's more to it than that. He can be more than just the legacy that was set up for him.
I find it interesting that you say he wants to go back to Amelia when, like, he had said in the last episode that, like, there was a girl and then there wasn't.
Oh, I took that to mean, like, the wasn't was, like, that he left to go see Dean kind of thing.
Ah.
This is very much a he went out for milk and hasn't come back yet type moment.
So he's been on a hunting trip and he hasn't been back in a few days?
He left a note saying I have to leave, like, mysteriously, but she's home with the dog wondering what happened to her boyfriend that just mysteriously vanished.
It definitely feels like Sam just has, like, this clarity of purpose right now, like, in this episode, because he's got, like, a vision. He's got, like, he's got 20/20 vision, you know? Like, but, like, he's got this plan and he knows how he wants to execute it. And it feels very much like the Sam who could have been if Jess hadn't gotten murdered in so many ways. Maybe this change of path is a way to get back to, like, the road not taken, to reclaim that legacy that he wanted for himself all those years ago. Like, think of the Sam from After School Special who was finally allowed to imagine for the first time a life outside of the family business. Realistically, I don't think that this was completely inconceivable for him to want to leave. I will still say that not answering his hunting phones was not a good move, but, like, I do think that there was some self-preservation there too.
I have a really weird relationship with Sam this season because, like, I was so anti-Sam at the beginning for, like, not looking for Dean and, like, not looking for Kevin. And while those are still very true, it's not to say that I don't agree with why he did what he did. I just don't like the way he did it. Sam understands that hunting is the family legacy, and despite both himself and Dean understanding that John wasn't someone to idolize or live like, Dean still sees it as a legacy. And I think maybe it's more of like a Bobby connection for him, but that's for another day. But Sam never wanted it, and he's made that his goal to create his own legacy with birthday cakes, and I'm willing to bet that he will actually try to find a way out. Like, there will be a separation at some point this season, and Lord knows the show will find a way to bring him back again. But, like, I really think he is serious when he says he wants out.
So you named to me what I think is the other piece of the puzzle, and that's Amelia. You don't know this yet, but people and fans really dislike this character and this whole arc. And I get that, right? So I'm letting you know, and I want people to know that I get that people don't like Amelia. But I don't personally dislike her. Like, if anything, I kind of like that we have this example of a woman that's unlikable at first. Like, she's mean to Sam in the first episode where we see her. And she's a little hard to love. But I also think that Sam knows a little bit about people who are hard to love, right? So maybe that works out. So anyway, just putting that aside, I do want to say that as much as Amelia seemed, like, super mean the first time we met her, you know, like, telling him that, like, oh, you know, like, if you were such a stand-up guy, you wouldn't have run the dog over in the first place. But I do have to put myself in her shoes. Like, this literal huge moose runs into your place of work, erratically screaming at your staff to save the dog that he ran over. And, like, if I'm being entirely honest, I don't think I would have been very nice to him either. And we do see in the flashback that she does love him. She cares for him. She bakes him cakes, you know? And maybe they've even talked about kids. And that's another form of legacy as well, that Sam is like, now, oh my goodness, maybe that's a possibility for me that I didn't think was a possibility before, right? And it doesn't mean that that's necessarily what he wants, but being able to consider it is new.
The not liking Amelia thing seems like a really interesting twist I was not ready for.
People hate her.
I did not realize the vet was also the girl that he was leaving. Like, I did not make the connection of the two of them.
And I didn't do a really good job at making that connection for you either. So let's be very clear.
If you had to do it, the show failed first.
Fair.
I know, I keep saying this, the flashbacks. I am looking forward to learning more about this year. For both of them, I want to know more about Purgatory Dean and his relationships and Cass, but I also want to know, like, more about Sam. I also want to know the dog's damn name. I want this dog to have a name, damn it. What's the dog's name?
His name is Riot.
That's how boring this episode was. I forgot that part. The only fun part.
The one dog that has a name, Drew.
I forgot his name is Riot, which I just think is a really silly name, but I kind of love it.
You didn't really think that maybe they could have been broken up? Let's entertain that idea here. And let's think about the fact that, like, if the relationship is over between Sam and Amelia, then the flashbacks are really, like, thinking back to that relationship, and therefore the flashbacks are the legacy of the relationship. If I'm thinking about like the really beautiful colors and everything, do you remember like when we usually see those things, like very like pops of colors and stuff?
I feel like heaven was very colorful, also full of flashbacks. Am I making the right connections here?
I was thinking more about the Jin episode.
A fake world made to be perfect for you. Maybe Sam's remembering things a little differently than they actually happened and is painting them in a much prettier light.
You know, when you go through a breakup sometimes and you're very, very sad about it, you tend to idealize certain parts of the relationship. And I'm wondering if there isn't a little bit of that going on as well. If they're broken up, of course.
That was always one of the things I had in the first episode that I kind of just like, I wrote off as being like, whatever, there's like a reason for it, we'll get to it later, or it's not important, was why Sam was going to the cabin in the woods. Because it seems like he wasn't going there very often at all, if ever, but he seemed to be going there with a purpose this time for some reason. Like he was like saying goodbye essentially to them before he left, even though they were both asleep, the Ryan and Amelia. So I'm wondering if maybe now, like, is that like the next day after the breakup and this is him like going somewhere else because he can't be there? And it just timed up perfectly with Dean's, I'm back.
Well, I mean, I think that Dean had called Sam, right? Like they were planning to meet up clearly. Like it's not like Dean was surprised to see Sam or anything like that. So there was, I think, like a plan.
I took Sam as being very surprised that he didn't expect it. I feel like Dean was like, he found the place. It was like waiting there for like a day or two until Sam would show up thinking he would come back. Hopefully I will learn more about this and not be as in the dark. Shall we move on to Dean for a little bit though? You know, like we know Dean got his taste of a life outside of hunting as well, but couldn't let it go. And I feel it's more out of a sense of justice and inability to sit idly by versus necessarily like a sense of legacy to his family job. But I can argue that now more than before, he does have an idol to consider, and I still love the image of Dean growing up to become the next Bobby type thing, taking over that role for future hunters, like truly allowing his legacy to live on forever. This week, it almost seems more like a compulsion, or like he's using it as an excuse to cope.
I guess I just don't really think that this is actually about legacy here. Right, like I think that Dean is using legacy as an excuse, but really, like, I think he's full on projecting. Because from what we saw last week, we can assume that Dean feels like a tremendous amount of guilt from whatever happened in Purgatory that meant that Cass didn't make it out. And he's in such pain and such a state of trauma that he's just like aiming those emotions at everyone, especially Sam, because Sam is the closest one and he's the one who's most around. And he's also somebody who he has legitimate reasons to be angry at, right? Like, it makes sense that Dean would be angry at Sam. Like, I don't want to take any of that away either. So that legitimate anger and that projected guilt and shame is making it so that Dean is an actual asshole to Sam, in my opinion anyway, right? Like, think of when one of your friends is not well, and I mean, like, mentally not well. Like, isn't that also, like, the time that they also tend to get, like, the nastiest with you? That's really what's happening with Dean right now in terms of, like, his little bitchy snaps at Sam, his, like, guess you missed that one too, or, like, do we ignore stuff like this, or are innocent people are supposed to die so that you can shop for produce? Like, Dean, please.
Again, it's very obvious that this, like, need to take on the next case isn't just, like you said, a carrying of legacy that's very much the excuse, but rather it's a need for him to keep going and working as a means to hide from his own thoughts. A bit of narcissism disguised as altruism, maybe.
Oh my god. Yeah, like some kind of congressman, one might say. But to be clear, though, I don't think that this is actually narcissism, but I do love the Taylor Swift plug.
Thank you. The thing I find most difficult this week is how Dean talks to Sam in the car when Sam says, Dean, listen, when this is over, when we close up shop on Kevin and the tablet, I'm done. I mean that. And Dean just says, no, you don't. Like, this, for some reason, is the most painfully dismissive and, like, ignorant line Dean is just so full on, like, imposing his own wants and worldviews on Sam's in such a way that it just feels so wrong. Like, Sam is just, like, a pawn in his life that he can control. And, like, it really stung me. And you know how much I love Dean, and I'm still, like, cagey with Sam this whole season.
If I could offer an alternative way to look at this, because I don't quite think that this is how I see it. So hopefully, like, it'll help you make a little bit of peace with Dean. I think that Dean is both projecting again and using his past knowledge and experience with Sam here. Because the line is, I'm done, I mean that. No, you don't. It's not, no, you're not done. It's, no, you don't mean that. And I do think that that makes a really big difference. Because he's not actually imposing his will on Sam the way that John would have, for example. He's saying, I know you. You have done this to me before, and you came back to hunting anyway. I know you don't mean it, so I just don't want to engage with that kind of talk. And there's also like the second part of Dean that's like drawing on his own experiences with quitting hunting, and like he knows that he missed it, right? Like that was his experience when he stopped hunting. He missed it, and we saw that. It was very clear. So he's like, you know, I know you, and I have my own experiences in this situation. And in my opinion, you don't actually really mean that. But because Dean is Dean, it comes out the way that it does.
It still feels very painful to me and very dismissive. I think for me, the big takeaway, like the thing that Dean isn't seeing, like, yes, Dean's like, well, no, like I tried taking a year off and it didn't work. But Sam did. Sam took a year off and didn't like crack. He was, as far as we know, wasn't sitting there with the radio listening to police scanners or like still checking like online news groups and sharing stuff. Like he said, he heard about it and just didn't. He let another hunter get to it because Lord knows there is one. And I think it's dismissing the fact that Sam did effectively get out and stay out and was not drawn back in, and then ignoring that on top of it. Like, you don't mean it. Yeah, he does. Because he just did it for a whole year, happily.
I think if you take the line of like, there was a girl and now there isn't, like what is anchoring Sam back into like the civilian world, the non-hunting world, if there is no more girl anymore?
Apparently going back to school, according to the phone calls.
That's something that is a possibility. And I completely agree with you. I think that Dean is really projecting like his own shit onto Sam at that moment. There's really nothing that I can say that is going to like erase that, but I'm just trying to understand his point of view because he's not doing a really great job at letting us in this moment, or letting us in, I guess, on like how he's actually thinking, because he's being so short with him and so like snarky. So we have to like really peel back the layers in order to like understand what's actually happening in his head. So I think that we can all agree that this episode was ridiculous in so many ways, right? And I'm kind of mad that we wasted Jensen Ackles' like directing chops on this. But such is life, and now this is what we have to look at and analyze in this particular episode. And I really want to talk about legacy in a more critical way here, particularly the way in which Buck Lemming episodes contribute to Supernatural's legacy as a piece of media that is not inclusive of anything outside of hegemonic systems of power. And I'm thinking specifically about white supremacy, patriarchy, settler colonialism, ableism, etc. And you know, we've commented on this before, that certain things on this show are very of their time as a way, I don't want to say to excuse, but to explain certain choices. But like, this was 2012. Right? Like, we knew better than to call a man in the middle of what seems to be a mental health crisis a mushroom. We knew better than to have your main character get excited about a crack whore bat. We knew that sex workers are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of it. We knew about the effects of settler colonialism in the Americas, and yet, we still got an episode like that. So that was a choice, right? Like, a conscious choice to portray your characters, but also your show in a specific light. It was a conscious choice to make fun of a fat person exercising, to make disparaging comments about ancient indigenous societies, to portray a sex worker as a predator, and to make fun of somebody in a mental health crisis. And all of these choices that could have been changed or vetoed at any point between script and screen, all of these things contribute to Supernatural's legacy as a show that furthered the hegemonic systems of power we talked about earlier.
Very well put. Thank you. This week we have a message from Nora. Before we listen to it, we want to remind you to send us a 3-minute voicemail. To respond to anything we discussed today or ask us a question, you can use the recording app on your phone and email us that recording at carryingwayward@gmail.com.
Hi, Mary and Drew. My name is Nora. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a huge fan of your podcast. I'm going to get this out of the way first. I am a theater major, so this is basically setting the premise for what this voicemail is going to be like. I will try to keep it to 3 minutes. But I wanted to talk about something I noticed from season 3, episode 1, The Magnificent Seven, that I was a little surprised you guys didn't talk about, but maybe that's just because you maybe didn't know it. I don't know. So at the beginning of the episode, where we see Dean in the motel with the twins and we see Sam in the car, the camera flashes down to what Sam is reading. At the top of the page, it says the name Dr. Faustus. Now, the reason that struck me is because Dr. Faustus is the name of a play by Kit Marlowe, an Elizabethan playwright. It's about a man named Dr. Faustus who gives up 24 years of his life for magic from the devil. He wants to learn the devil's secrets. He tries to summon the devil, but ends up summoning a demon named Mephistopheles. Mephistopheles accompanies Faustus during this play. They play pranks on powerful people. And there's one scene where they actually meet the 7 deadly sins. It's in a scene where Lucifer comes up and reminds Faustus that, oh, you've only got 24 years, so you're gonna come back down after that. One thing that I feel is very important to mention is that Mephistopheles is the one doing all of the magic that Faustus is supposedly performing. When the 24 years are up, Faustus is granted one last little thing, and he chooses to sleep with Helen of Troy, the most beautiful woman in the world. Sorry, I should have said spoilers, but oh well. And then he goes down to hell to stay there for the rest of eternity. The themes of this play include free will, good and evil, questioning God, the lot. I just found it so interesting that they didn't explore the story of Dr. Faustus a little bit more in the episode, because the themes of the play reflect a lot of the themes within the show, and Faustus's story reflects a lot of Sam and Dean's story. Dean's, especially within season 3, episode 1, and Sam's story, especially in season 4 and season 5. Mephistopheles also kind of parallels Ruby in a certain sense, the way that she orchestrates everything in season 4 and kind of manipulates Sam. So yeah, this is just something that I noticed and I thought was really, really cool. I could go on for days and days about the theatricality within Supernatural, how the boys have a certain sense of theatricality and how that reflects on their sense of masculinity, but I won't go into too much detail right now because I feel like there's an episode that's going to come up that discussion could be had a lot more effectively, and maybe I'll send in a voicemail then. Thank you so much for listening. I really love your podcast. Have a great day.
Nora, thank you so much for this voicemail. No, you're absolutely right. I had no idea about this. I am actually not well-versed in, this is going to sound crazy, but I'm not well-versed in English playwrights. It feels like, yeah, for somebody who knows, seeing Dr. Faustus, like it makes so much sense, right? But then I feel like this has happened before in this show where like a very important piece of literature is named or like just like hinted at, but then the parallels are never really drawn out properly or explicitly, right? It's always like, oh, there you go, like little nugget. And I agree with you, Nora. I do wish that they did a better job at that, because I think that like Supernatural draws on so much existing media and literature that I just kind of wish that they would draw those parallels all the way to the end. And yes, please do send us a voicemail about the theatricality of the brothers' masculinity for that one episode that we are both thinking about. I would absolutely love that. Thank you so much.
Well, Nora, may I just say, as someone who went to school with many theater students, I'm a big fan. And because of that, I actually do know this play, not well enough to really start drawing my own comparisons, but this feels kind of like, Mary, you were saying, I believe it's Death of a Salesman is the play in that episode.
Yeah, there's a mention of Death of a Salesman. Yeah, that's right.
And I think it's the kind of thing where it's like, there's definitely like someone in the crew who's like drawing these connections and like making these references and like, hey, prop guy, if you're going to put a book in, can you have it be this one? Like, sure, why not? Like, because someone's going to make the connection. There's the Noras out there who are going to see this and go, ah, I see what you did there. Even if the larger, you know, writing room and production team don't make the obvious connection or use it as a jumping off point. And I think that also does just come from the assumed crossover between the fandoms of people who have read this kind of or seen this kind of play versus watching the show. And based on what we know from the fans they wanted, I don't think they expected it or even wanted it, really. So I think we do miss out on more literary references and more different layers of culture that could be examined or used as a jumping off point because of this. I think this is part of the larger issue we've discussed in the past. I really do like that there are these little things that are still hidden. I like that we do miss things that people can bring to our attention.
We miss a lot of stuff.
But that's one of the best parts of this show, let alone this section, is getting those. So thank you very much, Nora, for bringing that up. And I am now just envisioning an episode of the show that I'm waiting for now, where we're going to see a stage play of the Supernatural books performed and Sam and Dean having to watch their own life played for them as like a cap show almost.
But now imagine if it was musical theater.
Oh my God. If we get a, like literally a high school auditorium, like musical theater adaptation of Supernatural, The Road So Far.
An all girls high school.
Oh my God, yes.
That would be beautiful. I would love that.
Avatar The Last Airbender in the animated series, at the very end, like right before the finale of the final season, they do that where they go and like watch a play of like, and it's like actually done from the point of view of like the enemy faction. Like, so it's kind of like propaganda-y of like, they're so evil, but it's just seeing all the like, just the, like through like word of mouth and like through the grapevine, like who these people really are. So I imagine, like, the exaggerations and the, like, not perfect, like, encapsulations of the characters could be really interesting to see on a show like that. I know we're not going to get it, but I can dream.
Is this fucking play about us?
That's exactly what we're going to get.
That's exactly what we're going to get. And the director is called Marie. Imagine.
I hope you know if this episode doesn't exist, you have to put it together somehow.
If it doesn't exist, I'll put it together. Drew, do you have any reflection and call to action this week?
I don't want to say I'm disliking Dean this season, but I'm seeing a lot more like negative aspects of him. And one of them very specifically that like really rubbed me the wrong way this week is his dismissal of Sam's wants and needs and like plans. And I think it's just a good reminder to myself that like, while I have my goals and things that I want to do, I should not be putting other people down or tearing down other people's ideas, thoughts, and wants to get what I want. Like, there is obviously a line between, like, not being ambitious and, like, giving up, but there's also, like, not being an asshole. So, I'm trying to be a little bit less like Dean this week and not be a jerk. And I hope that's not too rude, but I'm hoping Dean gets back in my good books next episode.
I mean, we've got a whole season of it, so hopefully he does.
Hopefully. Hopefully some flashbacks and some Benny time will clear things up. Mary, your thoughts and calls to action this week?
So as much as I dislike this episode, one thing that I do find interesting about it is that it kind of creates a contrast between like creating a legacy and living your life for yourself, for your own contentment, basically. And that's something that I think a lot about, to be honest, because inside me are two wolves, right? One that wants to like have an impact in my field of research and the community that I serve. And then there's also my desire to be a forest gremlin and to live off-grid. And I think that this is a very millennial experience, to be entirely honest with you. Like, these are very millennial wolves, you know what I mean? But either way, I'm feeling called to build or to design a career that is going to suit my needs, and same thing for my life, in a way that is basically going to feed those two wolves. This was Carrying Wayward, a supernatural podcast produced by Rochelle Castellano, hosted by Drew Shulman and Marie Vigourou. Thank you to everyone supporting us on Ko-fi or Patreon, especially our Bunker supporters, Elle, Jeremiah Thomas, and Simone. We'd also like to thank Jake Lionheart for our music and Jacqueline Tucci for additional sound editing. Head over to carryingwayward.com to become a patron or a Ko-fi subscriber and for our merch store and our socials. And write us a review on Apple Podcasts. Carry on, our wayward friends.